And I know we had a few that were going to go over 160 tonight and see David at his last time that he would be in the area. And I think that would be incredibly encouraging for him and his wife. And because I know they really fell in love with the people out in this area. And our prayers are with him as he eventually goes up to Fairbanks and preaches up there. I know we have a number that are also sick, you know, and I'm just grateful I'm not. And I'm here. We had a singing a while back, and sometimes you look around and you go like, oh, I just wish there were more people that could experience this. But that night I didn't think that. That night I simply thought, I'm simply glad I was here. There are certain times that you just, things happen and you can't recreate that. There's never going to be another night. There's never going to be another day particularly like that. And sometimes just the fact that you were there and you count yourself blessed. In the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the gentle, or the older translations will say in Matthew 5:5, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And in the English language, that word meek, and even the word gentle, for many people suggests someone that's easily pushed around. Someone who's just way too polite. Someone who's naive, who doesn't have a moral backbone. Someone that you can easily impose upon. And years ago, on the back of comic books, sometimes there was that the 90-pound weakling that was with his girlfriend at the beach, and someone kicked sand in his face and laughed at him, and then he took the Charles Atlas course, which was this like weightlifting course. But a lot of times people think of someone who's meek as the 98-pound weakling, very frail, and really can't take care of themselves. But the problem with that definition is that Jesus will use the same word about himself over in Matthew chapter 11 and verse 29. Jesus will take the word gentle or meek and say that's what he is. And so obviously he's not a pushover. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm gentle and humble in heart. Gentle, and I think the word gentle has that idea of I'm meek as well. Yet Jesus is the God, part of the Godhead, that brought the plagues, that opened up the Red Sea, that brought the flood. Jesus is pictured also as ruling the nations with a rod of iron in the book of Revelation. He's pictured as coming with his angels in flaming fire, dealing out retribution to those who do not know God or those who do not obey the gospel, 2 Thessalonians 1, 8 and 9. And he's going to judge the world one day, and at that day he's going to say to many people, depart from me, you who work lawlessness. And then he says he's meek. And so I need to factor that into my definition of meekness or gentleness. This is the same Jesus that's going to overturn tables in the temple and going to not permit people to bring any merchandise in, and is going to have a scourge of cords and is going to hit people with it. In John chapter 2 and in verse 15, he made a scourge of cords, drove them out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen, and he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And then he said, stop making my Father's house a house of merchandise. That's the same Jesus. This is the same Jesus that would say to Peter, get behind me, Satan. That's the same Jesus. It's the same Jesus that said, hey, when he gave down the law on marriage and divorce, that's a pretty tough statement. This is the same Jesus that did that. This is the same Jesus that told the rich young ruler, you got to sell everything you have. And he's all the same Jesus that publicly exposed the Pharisees and the scribes and the lawyers of his time as whitewashed tombs and hypocrites and men that were full of dead men's bones. So, God, I have to factor that into what does gentleness or meekness mean? One writer has the definition of gentleness of strength as a definition of meekness. A number of people say that one of the ideas that Jesus is really getting at here, or how the word had been used, was it's like a very powerful, let's say a horse, like a stallion, that you train it and kind of break it. And I mean, it can still kick your teeth out, but it's now under control. I don't know, maybe it's like a German shepherd that when you go up to it and pet it, it's all lovely, whatever, but if someone strange knocks on the door, all of a sudden it's showing all its teeth. That it, you kind of have both of that. It is a strength, but it's strength under control. It's channeled. Maybe another way of saying it is that a gentle person in this sense of the Bible word is someone who's patient and gentle and kind when they need to be, and forceful when they need to be. Or it's where your resistance is used properly. That instead of all your resistance being used against God, like some people do, your resistance is used against sin and darkness. Is that you love God with all your strength and you oppose sin with all your strength. And that you're very determined. You're very determined and adamant about that. I don't know, just this idea of strength under control. I remember my dad was not a Christian, but I remember my dad was a man, and my dad's in his 40s when I'm born, so he's like in his 50s as I'm growing up, and into his 60s when I'm in high school. But he could lay on the couch, and he would allow me and my little brother to kind of like, you know, roll all over him, go underneath there and roll all over him and stuff, and he's just laying on the couch, start reading or something like that, and he allowed us to do that. But I clearly remember one time we were up above Gates on the way to Detroit, and we went up there, went camping, and it was pretty primitive camping. We just had this little pickup, and you slept on this very thin thing on the in the floor of the pickup, and he had a piece of plywood that me and Mom then slept the other way, and him and my little brother slept one way, and we slept the other way, and you know, there was no heat, electric, or whatever. He just crawled into there and then crawled out in the morning, and there were some kind of like teenage boys, or maybe a little bit older than high school boys, that were messing around wanting to steal stuff, and he slips out with a loaded pistol and shoves it in their face, and I hear the conversation. He says, either get out of here or gonna blow your brains out. And maybe that might not be something that you'd recommend for someone to do today, but I remember my dad like that, of that there was a side of him that he would lay there, and as a kid you could roll around on and horseplay with, and very gentle, etc. But there was a part of him that I saw a couple of times, like we had a relative, and my dad was on top of him in the living room, calling him a liar, and had his knee in his chest, and it was a grown man, and I mean, very confrontational sort of thing. And I know, maybe I benefited from that, trying to, you know, that contrast there, that there was something about you that there was a strength there. And it would be like that stallion that, yeah, you could ride it or whatever, but you were also somewhat careful around it, like, you know, don't get behind it and type of thing. That, I mean, it can still kick. The real you. Who are you when no one's looking? When you're in a place that no one knows your name, remember the old show Cheers always talked about going to a place where everyone knows your name. But how would you act when you're somewhere where no one knows your name? Where you're like in a city that everyone's a stranger and no one knows who you are, no one knows you're a Christian. How do you act then? What would you do if you could get away with anything? Would you live any differently? And I think the person who's gentle or meek is the person who knows what they might do or what they would be tempted to do, what they're capable of doing. But they voluntarily choose not to do that because their allegiance now is to Jesus. Yeah, I know what I could do. I know what I'm capable of doing, but I'm not going to do it because Jesus died for me and God created me, and I owe him my everything. And I'm going to voluntarily choose to live differently here. And I'm not going to do that. And this is one of those things that to me is hard for a man who becomes a Christian, because what do you do with your strength when you become a Christian? You check it at the door. And I think God says, no, do not check your strength at the door. Use your strength to oppose evil and sin and darkness in your life with all your might. Use your strength to oppose dangerous people with all your might. And be protected of women and things like that. And call and expose evil and preach the truth when no one wants to hear it, sort of thing. Is that those are constructive ways of using your strength. Matthew chapter 26:53, again, when I look at Jesus again, it's on the night that he is arrested and Peter is pulling out the sword. Jesus says, do you think I cannot appeal to my Father and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? And I think what Jesus is getting at is that he still has a sword he could use, a real big one, and he knows how to use it. And he chooses to keep it in its sheath. And that might be another definition of meekness is a Christian man is a man who knows how to use his sword, but he keeps it sheathed. And he only pulls it. He doesn't pull it out when there's bad traffic. Okay? Too many men and weak men pull their sword out at all the wrong times. A man of strength pulls out a sword. I like, hey, you got someone leading people astray? Pull your sword out. People are teaching false doctrine? You got to pull your sword out. A young man needs advice? You got to pull your sword out, sort of thing. And there's something that kind of irritates you? No, that's not a time to pull your sword out. You're waiting in line somewhere? No, that's not a time to pull your sword out. We pull it out. We have to know when to pull it out, and we have to have wisdom there. Jesus is saying is that right now I could wipe everyone out here. I could wipe you all out. I could obliterate you. Yet there's something far more important than my comfort and my personal safety right now. And what's more important than that is, he says, how then would the scripture be fulfilled? Is that right now what's really, really important, and this is what is always really, really important, is that God's will be done and your salvation. And that has to take precedence over my feelings and my comfort. That takes precedence and what I would want. And I don't know, we probably need to be more like Jesus in that area of, there are things that are more important than your personal comfort at the moment. There are things that are more important than what you want to do. There are things more important than your immediate desires. And that is, God's will must be done. God's will must be done. In order to fulfill God's word, I will resist everything that could get in the way. I think that's a meek or gentle man or individual is, everything else is going to have to take a back seat to me obeying God. And that God's will be done in my life. I look at myself and I say to myself, am I good or am I fearful? Because there's a difference. There are people that abstain from certain sins not because they're good, but because they're afraid of the consequences. And to me, there's nothing inherently wrong being aware of the consequences or afraid of the consequences. But if the only reason you don't do that is because you're simply afraid of the consequences, that's not virtue. That's fear. Virtue is, I would not do it even if it was consequence-free. I would not do it even if there was no fear of me getting caught. It's like Joseph. How could I do that great evil and sin against God? And I need to look at myself and say, hey, Is the only reason I'm abstaining from certain things that are wrong is because, like, that could really complicate my life? Or is it because I would not do that under any situation or circumstance? Are you good, or are you simply fearful? There are people that go through life that, yeah, they don't get any really, really big trouble, but they don't do anything either. They don't do anything either for God. And life is more just more than what I did not do. Life is also what did I do with my talents and time. And God expects something more than simply politeness, because we're just being nice. And I don't want to run down, like, it's good to be nice, it's good to be polite, but there has to be something more there, because the people that are being told to be gentle are the people that are told you got to deny yourself and pick up your cross, and you got to crucify your flesh, and if your eye causes you to sin, you got to rip it out, and you have to be faithful unto death, Revelation 22, verse 10. And God has to come ahead of family, and you got to speak the truth when no one wants it, 2 Timothy 4:2. And you got to warn the wicked, Ezekiel chapter 3, verse 6, or Ephesians 5:11. And that's more than nice and polite. So, I don't know, hopefully when you meet someone who's gentle by Bible standards, you will see that there's an inner self-control there. There's a discipline there, but there's a strength about them as well. You know, I mean, that guy still has a sword, but he's choosing not to use it right now. But he's still got a sword. And also, where we're not dominated by fear and we're not governed by laziness or a lack of imagination. We're not naive. To me, the meek know what happens in the world. Because I think in the context of Matthew 5, they have sins. They've sinned. They're poor in spirit and they mourn, before we get to the word meek. So yeah, they've sinned and they know how the world works. And they know how evil people think. But they're prepared and they're ready for battle. I think a meek individual knows, or a gentle individual knows, that when someone's seeking to flatter them, they know that. They pick up on that. They know when someone's trying to bait them into a trap. Jesus was like that. The Pharisees would try to bait him to a trap, and he would say, "Why are you tempting me? Why are you doing that?" And so I think godly people are very aware of when they're trying to be lured into a trap. And they will have none of it. But the Bible also talks about, Jesus talked about his disciples being wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Or I think the American Standard actually says the word innocent as doves, shrewd as serpents, innocent as doves. And that's Matthew chapter 10, verse 16. But I don't ever thought, that never meant that we're supposed to be a rubber stamp for people. Or that we just, when I think of someone that is the wrong version of gentleness, I think of Jehoshaphat in the Old Testament, where Ahab says, "Hey, will you go up with me against these people?" And he goes, "Oh, sure, fine, yeah. You know, we should inquire of God, but even after that, I'm still going to go with you." Is that you're too agreeable. You're agreeable when you should not be agreeable. Like, no, I'm not going to help you in that. An innocent or harmless person of which Jesus was speaking is the same sort of person, though, that has a shield, has a sword, has a helmet, has a breastplate, and they're pictured as a soldier who's not working in the kitchen. And they're not in supply or in the mortar pool. I mean, in Ephesians chapter 6, every Christian is pictured as a frontline infantry in the battle type of soldier, and not someone that's far removed away from where the real battle is going on. When I look at the Sermon on the Mount, I kind of see this spiritual progression of blessed are the poor in spirit. I think it's the idea of that people that realize that before God, I stand spiritually bankrupt. I am lost, I'm condemned, I'm doomed, and I can't save myself, and I've made a mess out of my life. And then they mourn. They mourn not because they got caught. They mourn because they've sinned against God. And then you might say, well, how does this next one fit? Blessed are the gentle, blessed are the meek. I think one way that fits is that when God calls you a sinner, you say, you're right. You're absolutely right. That was one of the hardest things of me picking up the Bible and reading it for the first time, is that the Bible was yelling at me. It was screaming at me. It says, you are a sinner and you are lost and you are selfish. And it was screaming at me. And to be able to keep on reading when it's doing this, that's not easy. Because the temptation is to say, well, that's dumb, and shut it and walk away and say, no one's going to tell me what to do. And I think this is where you submit and you say, God, you are absolutely right. That's what I am. And I need help. Maybe that's kind of how it fits, or one place where it fits in the context, like how this logically progresses. But then it says that the meek inherit the earth. And maybe, I know this is a thought that maybe the first time I went through this or around that is like, well, wait a minute, doesn't the Bible also say that the earth is going to be burned up? 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 10. Yes. And so, I mean, it's very easy to think, well, that doesn't sound like a very good inheritance. Inherit the earth, but the earth is going to be burned up. So how does that fit? Actually, if we've read the Old Testament, what we will recognize is that inherit the earth is not a new statement. That's an old statement. That's a statement made to Israel back in Psalm 37, and it shows up, I think, at least twice in that psalm. Verse 9. Evildoers will be cut off, but those who wait for the Lord will inherit the land. In verse 11, but the humble will inherit the land. But when the psalm was given, the people were already in the land. I mean, you remember your chronology. The psalms are not written in the, you know, when typically when Moses is around. The psalms are written around the time of David and things like that. The psalms are like around 1,000 B.C., Israel's been in the land for a while. And so, inheriting the land that in the Gospels is now inheriting the earth, never really, it always meant something more than possessing it. Because when these people are told, hey, the humble will inherit the land, they've already got the land. They're already in the land of Canaan when that psalm was written. But have you ever read the psalm? Let's read just a little bit of it. Verse 1. Do not fret because of evildoers. Do not be envious toward wrongdoers. For they will wither quickly like the grass and fade like the green herb. Trust in the Lord, do good. Dwell in the land and cultivate faithfulness. Delight yourself in the Lord and He will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust also in Him and He will do it. He will bring forth your righteousness as the light and your judgment as the noonday. Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for Him. Do not fret. That's about the second time he said that. Because of him who prospers in the way. Because of the man who carries out wicked schemes. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret. It leads only to evil doing. For evil doers will be cut off. But those who wait for the Lord will inherit the land. Yet in a little while, and the wicked man will be no more. And you will look carefully for his place, and he will not be there. Now, this is the same psalm that says in verse 25, I've been young and now I'm old. So it's whoever's the person speaking here is speaking from experience. And according to verse 1, it's David is the writer. And then he says, yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken or his descendants begging bread.
All day long He is gracious and lends, and His descendants are a blessing. Now, this is the same psalm in verse 35, which says, I have seen a wicked, violent man spreading himself like a luxuriant tree in its native soil. Then he passed away, and lo, he was no more. I sought for him, but he could not be found. Mark the blameless man, and behold the upright.
Now, there's a lot of stuff going on in the psalm, but a number of things are, first of all, is there's going to be a temptation in life that you're going to see people that are not faithful. It could be they're not Christians. It could be they're a Christian and they're not very faithful, but it seems like they're getting away with it. It seems like that life is giving them a free pass, and maybe people are giving them a free pass. Is that no one's calling them for the damage they're doing in life. And it's not catching up to them. And maybe it seems like they're just blowing by you in life. From the standpoint of blessings and things like that, material blessings. And one thing this psalm says is that you got to stop worrying about that. Because if you keep worrying about that, you're going to end up doing wickedness. You're going to end up doing evil, and you're going to end up sinning. The other thing that the psalm says is that you're going to see people that it seems like that they were spreading out like this luxuriant tree, and all of a sudden they're chopped down. You're going to see that happen in life. And you're going to see people like the rabbit that blows by you, and you're the tortoise or the hare, blow by you. And yet, later on down the road, you're going to pass them up. And you're going to see people like the grasshopper that fiddles during harvest time, right? Having a great time, and you're the ant. You're the ant going to work every day. And it's a sunny day out there, and you're still the ant. You're going to work. And they're out there just fiddling and playing and buying stuff they can't afford, and you're the ant. And you're dealing with you're fixing your microwave with... You go to the appliance store and you're not buying a new one. You're putting in a $10 part. Okay, you're doing stuff like that, and you're the ant, and they're out there doing this, and you're the ant. And yet, this psalm says you're going to be the one that's going to inherit the land. Now, right now, it might not look like it. And right now it might look like that life is going really, really slow. And everything that you're doing doesn't seem to be multiplying very quickly. You're reading your Bible every day, and you're going to services on a Sunday night and a Wednesday night, and you're trying to do the right thing, and it just looks like you're not making a lot of progress. But all of a sudden one day you wake up and it's kind of like, you're where you need to be. And you're who you need to be. And I think David is saying to young people, particularly verse 37, is that if you're gonna key in on someone in life, key in on the righteous person that does what they need to do every day, key in on that person that's just kind of plugging away and watch them. Because the wicked, you're gonna look around and they're gonna be gone. And everything's collapsed on them. One thing I think what he's getting at is that this world is not our home. And I think today, either tonight or this morning, we sung a song that basically talked about this world is not our home. True, we're pilgrims here. But it's one of those strange things that while we're the people that recognize that this world is not our home, we also are the people that probably get more out of this world than anybody else does. From the standpoint of real, legitimate enjoyment. I think that's one thing Inherit the Earth means. Is that as a Christian, you're probably going to enjoy this life more than the next person. As far as each blessing in every day. One example of that, and I mean, study after study just confirms this. Who out there is having the most intimacy in their life?
It is not the guy at the bar. It's not the guy playing the field. It's not the guy that has his shirt buttoned down with the gold chains and stuff like that. It's not the guy that has his hat on backwards. It's not the guy trying to be a gangster. That's not the guy who's getting the most intimacy. It's the man who's been married. It's the married man. It's the married woman. That's who has the most romance. It's not the Hollywood actor or Hollywood starlet. It's the person, it's just the average person that's been married for quite a while. That's who has the best intimate life. That's who's getting the most romance. Study after study backs up that one. And I think that's one application of that the meek inherit the earth. The wicked. The trouble with the wicked is they can't really enjoy anything they've got. Because if they buy a new car and next year's model immediately comes out, they're going like, oh, I need that one now. I mean, it's the godly person is actually able to enjoy what they have. I remember talking to someone who said they had a friend that no matter what they ordered, they wanted what you ordered at a restaurant. That no matter what they ordered, they were not. It's like, oh, I'd rather have that. But I think a godly person, I can enjoy what I ordered. I can enjoy what actually life served me today on the menu. I know it might sound really, really strange, but one of my little joys is that, I mean, every year we got a lot of leaves on the property, right? And these trees the city planted, which are, I don't know, they're fine, but they got nuts now that are dropping, and they drip some pitch in the summer, and there's leaves all over. And when I come down here and I realize the street cleaner has come by from the building and swept up all our leaves, that's pure joy to me. Like, thank God. It's hallelujah. You know, that's just one of those things, like, I don't have to rake those things up. Somebody else did that. Okay, I can concentrate on other stuff, but that's one of my small little joys of life. The street cleaner came by this year, and it could get in because people from the apartment were gone that day. And that's, I don't know, that's just one of my little highs in life of, that's neat. I like that. Also, by not opting for instant gratification or sacrificing our future for today's short-lived pleasures, we truly get the most out of what life has to offer. And finally, a Christian is someone that can enjoy whatever life happens to be serving them right now at this moment. And I don't think people in the world, you get to the point where you can't do that, that if life is serving you something really neat, you're going like, yeah, that's okay, but I'd rather be, and I'd rather be, and I'd rather be. And they're always wanting to be someplace else or have something that's a little bit more. And there's something else here, is I think the Christian understands that since I know that no earthly thing is going to make me happy, I'm not setting myself up for disappointment. I mean, if I get something, if I finally kind of get the car or house or whatever that I was aiming for, I'm going to enjoy it because I was never demanding that that make me happy. I know that I'm going to be the same person when I get that. I know my level of happiness is pretty much going to be the same. I know that that's not going to satisfy me. So when I get it, I'm going to enjoy it for what it is. Simply a nice possession that's comfortable. But I never expected it to give me what Jesus can only provide me. That's an amazing blessing to have that in your life. All right. Yeah, one of the hardest things in your life is to bow the knee to God and say, God, you're right. It's kind of silly, though, isn't it? I mean, he made you, he created you. Of course, he's right. I guess I'm humbled by the fact that God took the time to write a book so I would know how to live. And that Jesus said, There's something more than his own comfort and his safety. Mark needs a covering for his sins, and so do each one of you. Be grateful for that. Let's be standing and singing the invitation song.